Before we begin, I would like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teachings and work at Del Seton Medical Center. Any discussions we have on this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and in no way connected to Del Seton Medical Center.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. My name is Lucas Ferrer and
Miguel Montero Baker.
And today we have part two, numero dos, of DVA rant, which was very fun.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to pick off where we left off, but I don't promise there'll be, we won't repeat some stuff. So I think last time, where did we leave off?
So I heard the last chapter, and I believe we focused a lot on deciding who is a good candidate and how we maneuver the decision of whether we want to do it endo, deep, or maybe superficial, open. And so what we said towards the end of our rant was that we would focus the next show on some more intraoperative technique and technical pearls of what's worked for us, and I think that would make for a very interesting conversation.
All right, cool. All right, let's start with just basics.
Yeah, like from the very top. Like I would say something. I would start, for example, with this question. So we've elected to do an arterization procedure.
Yeah.
You know, how do you prep for the case? Like, what are you going to need from the OR staff? How are you going to set the table? How are you going to set the patient up? Like, what are you looking for? So, walk me through the way that you like
my setup,
getting your setup.
Okay, so my setup is I already have an angio. I've done an angio. I know exactly what I'm going to find. It's usually pretty
correct,
close to where I'm going to do the procedure. So, you know, basics, integrated approach on all cases. And then you're going to have to choose your venous access. So let's just start with that access. So arterial access, pretty straightforward. I am using a 645 Terumo sheath.
Correct.
To go down. And we'll differ a little bit in our, how we do our crossings. And I think that, but I'll explain. I think it goes to act, my French size goes into how I access. And then I just do a barred halo sheath on the foot.
Okay.
And I usually access lateral plantar. I know you've been accessing the first metatarsal penetrating branch that connects the dorsum and the deep system. I've tried it. And it just, the wire just doesn't always go where I want it to go.
Correct.
So I've kind of like gave up on that because I was trying to be fancy and just like it was a hassle. So anyways, lateral plantar access, usually longitudinal view. That's that for access. So then
I would, you know, just to echo your feelings, fact of the matter is that perforating vein that connects the medial marginal on the top of the foot, on the dorsum of the foot, to the lateral plantar is seldom straight and of good quality. So, you know, don't get the wrong impression that that's like my go-to. It's, if anything, I'll take a look for shits and giggles. And if I'm like, whoa, this is huge and big, I'll consider doing that. But that's not necessarily my go-to. It's rare that that's going to be of good quality. And even if it's of good quality, it usually takes a couple of turns before it dives. And so it's hard to get the wire to maneuver that all the way down. So I wouldn't get overly excited about that. Do you use a tourniquet of any sort in getting access into the lateral plantar vein? Lately, do you think that that changes anything?
At the beginning, I did. Mm-hmm. But if it's big, it's big. I mean, if I can see it, I can see it. If I can't see it, then I'll put the tourniquet in. But most of the times, I already checked.
Like when is this a surgical tourniquet, or is this just like an IV tourniquet at the ankle?
I've tried everything. I've tried like the surgical tourniquet. I've tried an IV, the ortho one. I've tried everything, and now I'm just not using it. Okay. And then I usually go in when I get access just with a 018 wire.
How do you feel about ankle blocks? I've heard a few people saying that before they prep, they like to put an ankle block because it'll, quote, dilate the veins.
That makes sense if you're taking...
I haven't tried it. I don't know if that makes sense. I guess it makes physiologic sense that some of these blocks should provide some vasodilation.
Yeah. I guess if you need it. But if it's not of adequate size when you do your planning...
What about a warm compress? That's the other thing I've heard a lot of people say. I'll usually keep the foot wrapped. You know how we can have like a warm saline and they could just kind of put saline around it? Nope.
Yeah, to be honest, I always put a bear hugger underneath.
Okay.
That's standard. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So, and now you access not with the small little wire that comes with your access kit. I access with just an 018 wire. I love the Glide Advantage. It's expensive, but I like it, so I use it.
What length?
300 always. Yeah. And then I put in my forefront sheath. I always do like simultaneous arterial and venous grams, angiograms, venograms.
You put a short sheath? You said, is a halo a short one?
Or a short sheath.
Put a long halo?
I would do a short and I'll explain why, because I think that comes into why we do it differently. And then I use what I use to cross is Agassiz's vast technique. And I do 2 5-millimeter snares, one from above, one from below, right where I want to cross. And let's talk about, I try to cross as distal in a healthy vessel as possible, always. And then, what I do is I place the 5-millimeter gooseneck snares one on top of each other. I get an 014 nitrix wire. I puncture through both snares on an AP view, going straight down. And then I turn it 90 degrees, make sure that the snares are grabbing the needle. If they grab the needle, I pass the wire, come up with the needle, take the whatever the distal one, the more deeper one is, out first, grab with the other, and then that's the case.
I'm laughing because I don't normally use the VAS. It's not my go-to. But I had a distal DVA that I needed to do, and I needed to do this. And I was working a very tight spot, and it'd be fun to see August's reaction to this, but very, very tight. And so the two snares don't open up. Like, it's more like slits, right? Mm-hmm. It's like two little oval slit-like. And so it's fairly hard. I mean, the needle was about the size of the slit, to be precise. And finally, after a few things, I'm able to get them both, and I'm so proud of myself.
Yeah.
And I thread the wire 014 through, and I didn't change projection, so I didn't necessarily know which one was deeper.
Okay.
But I knew I was snared on both. Yeah. But I pulled the one at the top, and so all it did was slide the wire out of the one from the bottom, and I was like, wait, what
the hell?
Yeah. What just happened? But I was and I was alone. I had nobody to blame but myself.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so with the VAST, always remember, pull the one that's deeper and then pull the other one out, of course. Yeah, of course, right? I mean, that's common sense. But I didn't think about it at the time, but that was funny.
Yeah.
I think VAST is very useful for distal DVAs. I really do. I think it's very useful for that because you can't get a reentry device to track that far, or they're not going to be long enough.
Well, I think it's cheaper, first of all.
Is it?
Yeah, you just need a needle, two snares.
How much? I don't know how much.
How much is a? It's a
reentry catheter.
Yeah,
a couple thousand maybe.
Yeah, how much is a snare?
I have no idea. Be
like $200.
Is it?
I don't know. I imagine.
Oh, I don't have my phone. I was going to ask Siri. Anyway.
And I think it's also really good when you have to, instead of going from the posterior tibial artery to posterior tibial vein, you have to jump from the peroneal because you don't have a posterior tibial. When you have that, it's usually a longer distance, or like it's the angle's weird or something with that. It's just like, it's so simple. I think it's kind of, I try to make things as idiot proof as possible at all times.
Time efficiency. That's where I.
Yeah. I think it's also the most.
I need efficient. To get in and I need to get out and I need to go quick and I don't want to. Yeah.
Then you have it through and through. Then I usually hit the transition point with a Wolverine with a 3 cutting balloon.
So wait a minute. What catheter do you use to get the snare up? Use the snare's own catheter?
The snare's own catheter, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is usually like a, it's a 4 French
catheter. It's a 4 French catheter, yeah.
Is this a gooseneck?
Yeah, gooseneck. Okay. 5 millimeter gooseneck, or 6 millimeters, but five usually works. You externalize, and then hit the crossing portion with a 3 millimeter cutting.
So let me give another perspective before we... So for everybody that's listening, this is just another way to do it. I like to insert a long 4 French.
Mm-hmm.
So Cook has a 445 or a 455 that comes with an 018 dilator.
Mm-hmm.
And so with my 018 wire, which I don't necessarily use the Terumo 018, I like using the V18 control from Boston. I've got that part somewhere in the popliteal vein or femoral. The sheath then gets changed, and then I put a long sheath essentially all the way up to where I'm going to cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I remove everything, dilator and wire. And then what I have readily available in the cath labs, in the ORs, surgical suites, hybrid rooms, is a Trilo that we use so much for AAA work.
Yeah.
And if you push that naked into a 4 French sheath, it goes very because normally it has a catheter that's, I believe, 6 or 7 French that just wouldn't go.
Yeah,
but the idea here is because the 4 French sheath is long, then it is the catheter itself, right? So as you push the thing outside of the 4 French sheath, then that's what you maneuver in a way into the vein.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do from the artery is I push back, I push 8 and out that catheter. And so I use the reentry needle to poke out of the artery and essentially into the trilobe.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, I advance the 014 wire and I catch it between the snare and the 4 French sheath.
Mm.
And that's how I make my through and through. Yeah. So yours is vast. I use a reentry device just for people to have another perspective of how they could technically do it.
Yeah. So now after that, I usually just do a simple balloon angioplasty to 4 millimeters of the vein. And then I see where the valves are and where I have wastes. And if those don't resolve, I go hit it with a scoring balloon or a cutting balloon if I need to. And then after I do that, I bring in an 035 catheter through that through and through wire, and then I feed a buddy wire because you have your venous access sheath still there. So before I get to I take that sheath, the venous sheath, back as much as I can, usually with the dilator, just leaving the tip of the dilator in the vein, and then I bring the 035 catheter with a buddy wire, and then having still that secured access, I buddy wire the penetrating branch into the dorsal system. And once I secure that, then I take my venous sheath out an eye angioplasty and get hemostasis.
Okay.
And then after I do that, I stent. I usually stent to try to keep it upper third of the calcaneus.
How many times do you have problems with hemostasis?
None. When I do that, none.
Never?
Never.
You've never had a bleeding out of the hole from the poke?
Since I'm doing that, no.
What were you doing before that would create a hole?
I would just cannulate. I would remove my venous axis while having a catheter down there without having passed the wire all the way to the dorsal system, being able to do endohemostasis.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
How many times do you feel, one of the things that I see frequently happening, and I guess we have to preface with saying that these are all off the shelf.
Yeah, these are off the shelf
alternatives. And that you would essentially bypass a lot of this if you did have access to the now commercially available LymphFlow device. But I do find that it's sometimes a technical hurdle to not have the catheter or tool to break the main lateral plantar valve, which is usually in the mid portion of the foot. So once you do, let's say you do throw that wire into the arch and you're able to get into the medial marginal backwards and or into the GSV, and you balloon angioplasty that mid portion, which is a lot of times very close to where you access, there's like a weird little valve there. And I feel like,
well, do you see it? Like after I angioplasty, and sometimes I do cutting balloon angioplasty if I need to, I radiographically, I'm not seeing any issues. So I don't know. I mean, it's there, it's flopping around doing this little thing. But it's, you know, when these things fail, that what I've seen is that they fail at the distal end of the stent, and it's like a severe neointimal hyperplasia that happens at the end of the stent. I don't think it's a valve. I don't know if it's not a valve. It could be a remaining valve there. But I think that even with the LymphFlow system where you use the antegrade valvulotome, you still got that neointimal hyperplasia right there. So by exclusion, I think that the valve, if you can just get it to resolve angiographically with ballooning, that's fine.
I feel like there's just, I've got a couple of cases that the arterialization was moving through the arch. And then you realize when you come and check signals the next morning that you don't have the multiphasic signals that you would like to have. And I've gone back.
Yeah.
And the problem is there's a retained valve in the mid lateral plantar vein.
Yeah.
Like,
so what,
unequivocally.
So what you can do is what the Italians do, right? They get a bent wire, they buddy wire it with another one, and they use the bent wire and the catheter as a valve.
Yeah. So you wire the valve past the valve. You get back into the arch and you park the wire into the medial marginal or way up JSV. Then you bring an O35 catheter, like let's say a vert down. And that vert inevitably is going to have a lot of space because you put an O14 wire through.
Yeah.
And now through the space that's left, you're going to maybe advance an O18 wire. And the idea is,
you give it a little curves,
that the O18 wire is going to come out, and instead of going through the valve, you are going to try to get it to hit the leaflet and kind of curl up.
Knuckle, yeah.
So essentially, you have a scissor.
Yeah.
Right? The O14 wire is straight through the valve. The catheter is behind, and you're catching the leaflet between the wire that's through it and the wire that's buckled. And all you have to do there is push, because that'll cut the buckled wire acts as a traumatic element. And the fact that you have the O14 wire distally makes sure that that catheter's vectors of force is projected upon the leaflets alone.
Yeah.
Okay. So
is there a role for IVUS at all?
I think if you're having issues dealing with a valve,
yeah,
I think it helps you understand. You can see very well the valves.
Yeah.
And so I
use it regularly?
Not regularly. Yeah. I use it whenever a case is not going straightforward.
Yeah.
I throw it down there and I try to understand if what I'm having is duplicity, like it's a duplicated thing. Is it a bridge? Am I in a weird area of a vein that I don't understand? Is there a valve?
Yeah.
That's when I usually use it.
Okay. So then you lyse your veins, however, you know, the method du jour that day is. And then.
Have you been hurt later?
Yeah.
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard some guys saying that they throw that wire and instead of doing all this stuff, they just put in a laser catheter and essentially melt the valves away.
Which what laser did they, the specifics?
They didn't give me a specific
size, but catheter.
I'm guessing a 1.4, a 1.8, the Phillips.
Yeah, I would be scared of using a 2.
I would be also. But using a turbo power can potentially extrinsic, you know, get you away enough to where you can catch it. I'd be more afraid that the leaflet would just kind of slough off the laser and just, oh, there's a laser catheter. Let's move to the side. And, you know, it wouldn't catch the laser itself. That's why I would be a little.
Yeah. Yeah. I would probably use it low power, like low joules, and but a bigger catheter.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So. We got the valve lysis, now stents. What's your, do you stent distal first, proximal last? How do you stent?
I always stent distal first and I go, and I would say 8 out of 10 times I pull a 525.
Yeah, always, yeah, me too.
It's just, it gives you the most coverage and a lot of times if you do that crossing distal enough, one stent is all you need.
Yeah.
Which is what I aim to try to keep procedures to one stent, but I would say that on average two.
On average, I need to use
two. Rarely three.
Yeah.
But on average two.
Yeah, I don't think I've used three, but yeah, two.
525 and then a 5100.
Yeah.
To adjust for the crossing.
Or 150. Yeah. Cool. So you got that. Do you post dilate? And to what?
Oh, yeah.
To what?
I go one down. So I usually post dilate with a 4.
With a 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing fives, but then I changed to fours. To keep it, keep the resistance higher.
I think the, well, not only that, but I do think that at the beginning I was like very disrespectful to the veins.
Yeah.
Like I was like, bam, 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 bam.
Yeah.
And through a series of different exercises and experiences that I've had, I've realized that if the more you preserve the vein, the probably the less problems you're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
The less trauma you create on the vein, and we've seen some of this histology already in some of our we've literally started studying some of these cases at Methodist with Trisha, and you can see
with the MRIs.
So pre-operative MRIs, but then more importantly than that is we're taking some of the specimens post-arterialization. You know, like if a, let's say, case doesn't go well and they lose their leg.
Yeah.
Or if case is going great and they're getting a guillotine TMA, we're sending all that tissue.
Yeah.
So that we can see what the arterialized venous segments look like.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of
funky changes.
There's a lot of growth to a lot of tissue and a lot of stuff that's happening in there. And I do believe that it's probably traumatic from a lot of what we do on the first procedure.
A lot of these
specimens have been early specimens and so you can see a lot of the acute changes.
So a big cause of failure of the procedure is early failure, right, of the or early thrombosis of the graft within the first 3 months, right? That's a big cause of it. And I find that the source of that could be that neonatal hyperplasia that forms at the end of the stent. Like I routinely, because like my ultrasound people don't know how to look at this, right? They do like a normal duplex for a bypass or a stent.
Well, maybe you should help them get trained in that.
I know, but you have to tell me when you're going to do your session.
Oh, we actually have a date, I think. Well, I would call Jill right now, but she's not going to pick up.
Yeah, she didn't pick up last time. So why do you think that early neuroendomalvoplasia at the end of the stent happens?
The only thing I can say is based on the very early stage research we've done is this is an active endothelium that is going to get severely traumatized by the repetitive systolic insult.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in animal models, you see very, very, very acute changes in, mm-hmm. in mice and dogs mm-hmm. that have been done. If you look at most of this arterialization research was actually related to congenital heart disease. And a lot of those studies show that within literally days, you have severe intimal hyperplasia. So I do believe that it's just the nature of the disease. Like it's the nature of the physiology changes you're creating.
Yeah.
But also the, I guess this is also hypothetically, there's probably some relationship to how you treat or mistreat the vein on the acute setting.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying before, you know, initially it was more like I wanted to rip the heck out of everything, break it. I didn't care. And then I would just put a stent because essentially I'm doing that. And now I feel that if I can get a 4 millimeter balloon open throughout,
that's fine.
Then that's very okay.
With 3.5, because I still think
the more I do this, Lucas, and I superficially started talking about that, but the more I do this, the more I realize that these fistulas should be very low flow.
Yeah.
Not too sluggish to where they're going to occlude, the next day.
Yeah.
But, you know, at some point I thought 250 and below, and I have actually
kept going down.
Yeah, I think 100, maybe the sweet spot 80 to 100.
Yeah.
I think that works well to where it's not creating that much steel.
Yeah.
But it is creating the purpose of antegrade flow and oxygenation.
There's a
oxygenation. Hey, we got an ESL. Yeah, we're gonna start collecting our ESL bloopers.
Yeah. All right. So
oxygenation.
All right. So the next two kind of adjuvant things are coiling, and we talked a little bit about that. When you get your arterial circuit in line, there's a very low resistance signal on the Doppler. And you can elicit a change to a more high resistance signal by just manual pressure on the GSV. And maybe that is a sign that you need to coil the GSV to increase that resistance, decrease the flow. Because, you know, from the vast literature, again, from August Sisa, where he's having, you know, equivalent success rates, shows that his flow volumes are less. If I remember correctly, there were in what we were talking about to 100 range.
I would have to call Martha or August too.
Yeah. But so maybe that should be something that we should take into consideration.
I think probably that is a number that needs to be normalized in a way to each case. Because I think it has to do with what you have to begin with. So let's say, imagine a total whiteout, total desert, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Then that's a patient that probably, you know, under 100 is actually going to be almost like you have to
do under 100.
You have to 100%. Yeah. This guy's not going to tolerate anything a little bit more than that. But let's say that it's, let's say it's a 4 foot gangrene on somebody with a PT that's pretty bad and the PT's kind of okay. That guy maybe he'll do okay with a 200 or 250.
Why do you want more flow? Yeah, I think
I'm just saying, I just don't think that you can cast this categorical number on everybody.
Yeah.
Probably you could say, well, if 100 works for this guy, well, why don't you just do for that for everybody and remove the risk? And I guess that's fair enough to say. I just think that if you're thinking of it critically, it just has to do with some people will tolerate it more than others.
Yeah.
I do think that you have to pay very close attention when you're doing this to the early signs of steal.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I always tell myself as I'm doing this is I look at the patterns of what I have to begin with. So let's say, you know, trickle flow into the perineal that goes into an anterior perforator that has some trickle yet very disease flow into the dorsalis penis, for example. That's all we got to begin. And I do an arterialization and I open and I finish and I'm doing my graduation pictures. And now all of a sudden that trickle anterior tibial is actually not lighting up.
Yeah, at all.
Or even worse, you see it contrast go down the AT for maybe a couple centimeters and then it gets sucked back up and then goes into the arterialization. Yeah. So it's not only not going that way, but now it's reversed.
Yeah.
That's a sign that you have to do something to modulate the flow. And so I pay very close attention to the hemodynamics of the angiography towards the end. And that gives me a good idea of, is this patient someone that I need to make sure that I come out with a low volume fistula? Because I'm seeing angiographic reasons that are going to compromise the flow to that trickle artery that's keeping the foot alive.
Yeah.
And so, and then that's where, you know, potentially we can complement that with saying, you know what, bring me an intraoperative Doppler. I'm going to show signals and then I'm going to do bets like on the spot, some occlusive maneuvers.
Yeah.
Where, you know, let's say, and you have this really, and I'm going to dampen, I'm going to put my finger over the medial marginal vein. So obliterating outflow, which essentially is creating outflow resistance. And let's say that that thing goes from to then you probably have a pretty good reason to say, I'm either going to just open the medial marginal and ligate it, or I'm going to wire it and drop a couple of coils in a couple of these things. Because it's obvious by A, the angiography that shows clear steel.
Yeah.
And by my Doppler with superficial occlusion, that there is a modulation of flow, then just do it. I wouldn't wait for it to happen.
Have you seen decrease in flow volumes just from applying pressure in the GSV? I've never tried.
I've never done volume flow measurements with and without outflow pressure. I do, however, find that I can make Doppler. And this is obviously qualitative data, but not quantitative data. That there is a change in the hemodynamic response and that there's probably going to be an improvement based on what I'm wanting to do.
You know, one of the things I do, and I don't know if it makes any sense, is that when I think that there is too much flow, there is steel, I go, I take a shot under like 6 frames per second, and then I go frame by frame and I look where the blood is stealing to first, as a strategy to coil that vessel first.
Okay.
Does that make any sense? Or should you just go, or do you just go GSV? Coil the GSV first.
No, I think it makes sense. I think if, let's say that you are limited by your own scope in the sense that you don't have the ability to do a surgical cut down, because I'm always advocating for just cut down to the medial marginal vein and put a stitch around it because it's so easy.
I hate those wounds.
It's so easy.
I know, but they take forever to heal.
But you could do it. You could also do it with a stitch.
It's an ischemic.
You could do it with a stitch from the outside, right? You could grab a Vicryl.
I like try to like pamper that skin, not have it like anything touch it. It's like, don't touch it.
Okay, fair enough. If you're not gonna do this more aggressive cut down based or stitch based approach, I do believe that you have to look at the angiography because you're probably going to go into the tarsals. Like it's not, you know,
yeah.
it's,
It's, going it usually goes medial, like straight up or 90 degree angle.
And you have like four of them.
Yeah.
Three or four of them that you can selectively cannulate.
Yeah.
And because of how tortuous they are, the coils actually respond very well.
Yeah.
Have I done the one that feels first? No, but I think it makes sense. Just if the flow is going that way, it's probably the highest flowing area that if you knock it down, just be cautious enough to make sure that there's still some outflow, right? I mean, you don't want to ligate the main one. And that actually goes to the podiatrist too, because I had that.
Yeah.
Remember, I had that in a couple of cases, or probably one case where I coil embolized a lot. The flow looked beautiful. I was very, very happy, but essentially I left one outflow track and it was doing very well. But the moment that the podiatrist did the TMA, they ligated the one track that was there and the whole thing went down.
Yeah.
So you also have to think about not only what's happening now, but what's going to happen the moment you cut back.
Yeah.
And you're inevitably going to ligate some of these things as you bring the incisional line back. And so as you're taking that decision, also consider overlaying what tissue loss is there and how many of those are actually going to go out just from the surgical podiatric intervention.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
like at some point they're just going to feed off.
If you cut that and you can make a visual estimate and say, okay, well, if I'm going to do the osteotomy here and that's going to, the osteotomy should be a centimeter ahead, what of all this am I going to ligate in doing that guillotine TMA? And then consider that to say, well, maybe I should leave at least one of these tarsals.
Yeah.
Because otherwise there's going to be no outflow.
Yeah.
So consider that also as a technical pearl.
Yeah. And then the next adjuvant thing that gets, you know, thrown around in the podium presentations are valve lysis of the metatarsal veins.
Metatarsal.
So I find that it's difficult sometimes to.
Very difficult.
Yeah. So if I can get in, I angioplasty them with a 2 millimeter balloon, but that's it. I don't know if it does anything. Absolutely. I don't see a great difference in the angiograms afterwards. I can find it, like if I know where, you know, if I usually know where I did it. So I go try to get a signal. Sometimes I can get a signal with a Doppler right into the interweb space, but I don't know if I'm doing anything.
First, if the wire goes, I'll also drop a balloon in there. But I also try to bring like an 035 Navicross so that it purposely catches on the valves and I just push it. Like,
if the doesn't need to like make a bunch of turns to get in, it needs to go up and then it needs to go right or left and then
do it.
Yeah. I haven't tried it.
The Navicross is an incredibly responsive catheter.
Yeah.
It torques like a wire.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, I'd come down with it and as it's going up, I'd kind of swing it a little bit upwards. Then I'd flip it again so that the angle is looking forward and push. And it's going to hang. It's going to do this. Yeah. And that's where I feel it's the valve. And I just push. And what I do also from the outside is I grab the foot and I kind of wiggle it a little bit so that there's more force into the catheter. So I'll have somebody push the catheter forward and I just jerk the foot a little bit and that just, and it pops it. I mean, it's just,
I don't know.
You're just playing with it from outside and inside. And I think conceptually a lot of people agree that if you can knock a metatarsal valve, it'll accelerate the recruitment process. And I do firmly believe that. Most of the cases that
I love how this is like all faith.
Oh, totally.
It's like, I believe this.
Yeah.
Down to it's like, because we don't know anything about the mechanism of this.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. What do you, couple last things. Stenting the proximal, let's say you're putting a 5 millimeter stent and you're obviously putting part of it into the arterial segment. Yeah. I've been burnt before by what I think is infolding, meaning the 5 millimeter balloon stent is crippled. And this, of course, applies only to the off the shelf because the LimFlow device has actually a
tapered
stent, which accommodates very nicely. But if you don't have that, do you tend to use it like a coronary stent to just smash it all? And
this is where IVUS, and if the IVUS looks perfect, I leave it alone.
I think that makes sense.
If it doesn't,
we just had a case 2 days before, where we were using IVUS to decide on something else. It was like more of a proximal. And I already had my coronary stent ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And when I IVUS, I was like, there's actually not whole lot of infolding.
Yeah, no.
Like, I thought I was going to see a lot of crimping, but the only thing that happens is it looks like the struts just come together. Yeah,
like
but they don't. It doesn't seem to be like a lot of luminal effect. So,
yeah,
you know, I'd be curious to see some of these 5 millimeter Viabonds into 3 millimeter models,
mm-hmm.
and just put a camera in and see how much, if any, infolding. Because I don't
Gore,
know.
You can you can hire us to check this out for you.
Yeah, well, you should sponsor the Life of Flow podcast first, and then you can hire us to see this. Anyway, I think that's definitely what we do. About 40 minutes worth of pearls for our audience. These are things that, by all means, do not think that this is the way it should be done. These are things that we just think is the way that should be done. And if you're ever tickled by this procedure, listen to this and be aware that I always say you learn the good and the bad from people. So if we said something that makes absolutely no sense, then by all means,
let us know.
Yeah. Don't do it. Just don't do it. Don't take it to heart. Don't think that this is a Bible or in any way, shape, or form telling you how things should be done. This is what works for us. So anyway, fun. Listen, y'all, thank you very much for...
maybe a part three?
We definitely... I think part three focus on post-op care.
Follow up.
What are we looking on ultrasounds?
Yeah.
Wound care. How do we decide on when to intervene? The good, the bad, the ugly of the post-op care, the storm, the pain,
mm-hmm.
these things that are really hard to manage, the family.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's rough.
The constant texts.
Yep. A lot in admissions 2-3 times in the first 3 months. All right. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be with you shortly another day.
Next time. All right. Bye.